Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Speaking to you from Washington, D.C. today, and I'll be joined a bit later by our hometown intrepid Beltway reporter Todd Zwillick with a dramatic and comedic look at the long-term conservative lightning rod on the U.S. Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia. But we begin this hour with a terrifying thought. If hundreds and thousands of people are trying to escape their homelands to Libya, what does that say about the brutality and desperation right now in the Middle East? Places like Syria, Eritrea, Egypt, Somalia, and Nigeria, where people bound for Libya as a way station to Europe, many of them ending up in worse chaos or dead. Here's Libyan Foreign Minister Mohamed al-Dairi in February reminding the world that Libya itself right now is a land of al-Qaeda and ISIS made chaos.
The challenges facing the legitimate authorities of Libya are enormous. Now that armed terrorist groups have taken possession of whole cities in Libya and proclaiming al-Qaeda doctrine.
As many as 900 migrants perished in the Mediterranean just this past weekend, fleeing their war-torn homelands on boats bound for Europe from Tripoli. The Tunisian captain of the boat has since been charged with reckless multiple homicide. But instability in Libya and Tripoli's central location on the Mediterranean make it a hotspot for human smuggling. 1,500 have died making the same crossing in just the first few months of 2015. We're going to spend a few minutes now with Bill Lawrence, author of After the Uprisings, Political Transition in Tunisia, Libya, and Yemen. He's a former senior advisor for the U.S. State Department. Bill, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
How would you say, Bill, that the Arab Spring has in part set the stage for this chaos on the Mediterranean coast?
Well, this is a problem that predates the Arab Spring, going all the way back to about 2000 when we started to see spikes of immigrant flows from Africa going towards Europe. But it's gotten much worse since the Arab Spring. And what was happening before the Arab Spring is that governments were able to work with European authorities to stem the tide. And since the Arab Spring, we have chaos. We have wide open areas with no governmental controls. And the flows are flows we've never seen before. 140,000 just last year arrived on the shores of Italy from Libya. These are big numbers. And then again, the 11 or 1,200 that died just in the last 8 days in shipwrecks, this is unprecedented.
And you've got the big numbers in southern Europe. You've got the huge numbers in Turkey and Jordan. But then you have this sort of netherworld, this area where, as you say, there are no governing authorities. There are no responsible institutions for the international community to deal with. The U.S. has almost no clout in the region where people are most in peril. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, nobody has clout. I mean, we've transitioned from a world where the U.S. and the Soviet Union, remember, they had their sort of hegemony over large areas and large numbers of countries. And you know, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was a unipolar world where the U.S. was the strongest. Now China is rising in this part of the world, but there's really no outside force that is a stabilizing influence. And in this vacuum of geopolitical hegemony or geopolitical stability, you have these large areas now of ungoverned spaces and opportunistic militias who are fighting not over just ideological things like your setup piece just described, but also smuggling routes. Most of the fighting in Libya over the last 4 years has been control over border crossings, airports, seaports, to extract rents on the very smuggling and trafficking flows that we're talking about.
And rents that al-Qaeda and ISIS have a hand in, and they're a part of the smuggling operation itself. There's no way really for us to talk in any useful way about what the sort of short-term implications are, because the humanitarian crisis is so huge, it's almost obvious. But if the Syrian civil war were to end tomorrow, would it become a place where people would return? In any sense, could this reverse itself, or is there no sort of long-term scenario that looks like it would reverse this situation?
Most people are saying that many of the 4 or 5 million refugees that have left Syria will not return. Certainly a lot of Libyans would not go back given the current chaos. And of course, these economic migrants from Eritrea, from Mali, from Nigeria and the other countries, they're also producing tens of thousands of migrants. Those people aren't going back. In fact, I've met many of them, and they try 4, 5, 6, 7 times to cross. So they just keep trying and keep coming.
Bill Lawrence, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bill Lawrence is author of After the Uprisings, Political Transition in Tunisia, Libya, and Yemen. He's a former senior advisor for the U.S. State Department.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The final legal steps to legalizing same-sex marriage are likely to take place narrowly or broadly during the current term of the U.S. Supreme Court. But the journey to declare laws against gay marriage unconstitutional discrimination took their biggest legal steps in the 2010 case of Hollingsworth v. Perry. The 2010 Supreme Court decision that overturned California's Proposition 8, which had banned same-sex marriage under statewide ballot measure. Hollingsworth v. Perry was quite literally a court case where life, love, and marriage were on trial. Witnesses were called. Points about love, feeling, being gay, and being married had to be proved in open court.
What if someone were to say, well, you've just chosen at one point in your life to be with a man, and now you've chosen at another point in your life to be with a woman. Couldn't you choose to be with a man again?
When I met Chris and fell in love with her, it was actually the first time I could even identify with the phrase, being in love. And at 37 years old, I discovered something about myself that I hadn't known before. But I can't change who I am. I simply am who I am.
And that is a lesbian.
That is a lesbian.
That's Attorney Ted Olson questioning one of the plaintiffs, Sandy Steer, there from the HBO documentary, The Case Against Eight. This trial, Hollingsworth v. Perry, was a landmark for many reasons, and its courtroom drama may stand as a peak of jurisprudence for decades to come. Kenji Yoshino, constitutional law professor at New York University School of Law, has captured that in his remarkable new book, Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, that's out today. This was a case where brilliant lawyers, passionate clients, and rational judges brought the clarity of the law together with its humanity and, in a way, with its poetry. Kenji, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much, John. It's great to be with you.
You really capture what it was like in that courtroom, and you discovered it even in just reading the transcript. It all came out and came to life for you in this narrative that you tell. It's quite a story.
Thanks so much. That's exactly right. I sort of started reading the transcript and, you know, had kept my distance from the trial because a lot of the movement lawyers had been against it. But once I started reading the transcript, I kind of fell into it. And I had the experience that I think a lot of readers have, maybe the experience that defines us as readers, of turning the first page and not surfacing into everyday life until I'd finished the 3,000-page transcript sort of some days later.
And you allude to this, that the movement movement for gay rights was really concerned that this would create bad law, bad precedent, and you were a part of that and were hesitant. But when it was a successful case and you were able to look into the transcript itself, what did you see that Ted Olson and Boyce, his co-counsel, did in this case?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, in fairness, at the time when the case was brought, the objection really wasn't on my part or on the movement group's parts against any of the merits claims. It was rather just on timing. Only 4 states, it's hard to remember this, John, had same-sex marriage at the time. So I think we thought it was a really risky proposition. But the game changer for me, exactly as you said, was just engaging with the trial. So what they gave us that had never happened before, except for a minor state trial in Hawaii long before marriage was on the national consciousness, 14 years before this trial, there had never been a full trial on all of the issues. So what Chief Judge Von Walker did was to really give the nation the privilege of having every single issue vetted. And so we had 12 days of testimony, 8 lay witnesses, 9 expert witnesses. So every claim that the other side made about whether gay people were bad parents, whether this would negatively affect opposite sex marriage, whether this would hurt religious liberties, was just raised and then completely destroyed and debunked in a way that is just not possible in a referendum context or even in an academic debate where a smart person can pivot or avoid the question.
Or even on a radio show. I mean, you are a person with irrepressible optimism, and your reputation in coming through law school as a very talented law student, I think, is consistent with that. Nevertheless, it seems to me in this book you found yourself really astounded that the courtroom was a place for judges to really think about love. What is it? Marriage? Happiness? What is it? And that's what you found here.
Yeah.
Is the courtroom a good place for that?
Yeah, it was extraordinary. So, I mean, thank you for understanding the book so well, because I really thought of trials as being, you know, just I didn't really have any strong priors about whether trials were a good thing or a bad thing. But the thing that really struck me about this trial was just the sheer humanity of it, that these were not sort of platonic abstractions dueling with each other. And as David Boies said, papers talk past each other. You really need human beings confronting each other in order to understand the full stakes of what's going on. So it's not just really moving testimony by the individual plaintiffs, as we heard from Sandy Steer earlier in the clip that you played. But it's also, when we're talking about the question of immutability, you and I can go back and forth about whether sexual orientation is immutable or not as a characteristic. But when you get Ryan Kendall, who was a young man, 26-year-old years old at the time, who had gone through conversion therapy, going through the harrowing experience of that, and testifying on the stand that his mother had said to him, as an evangelical Christian herself, that she would have rather have had an abortion than have a gay son, sent him into conversion therapy, and he became so depressed under the kind of rigors of the conversion therapy that he decided that he was going to commit suicide, and ultimately had to emancipate himself from his parents. And so when he gave this testimony on the stand, it really brought to life what the real stakes are, what the lived stakes are of becoming homeless, becoming a drug addict because you had gone through this conversion therapy. And I think that's different in kind from having these very abstract academic debates. And I think the beauty of the trial was that it didn't just do that. It also created not just narrative compassion, but what Elaine Scarry up at Harvard calls statistical compassion, where 2 days after he testified, again, I think you and I and many of the listeners here as smart people would say, okay, that's really moving, but I can't make policy based on one moving story, so show me the data. 2 days later, Boies and Olson brought forward a psychology expert, Gregory Herrick, who just brought out all his charts and studies and said, you know, 92% of people can't change their sexual orientation. So it was a 1-2 punch, you know, both the narrative and the data that made for such a powerful presentation that was unprecedented in our nation's history.
Information, truth, and passion for the law trump all the ideology that we find infecting our government. Kenji Yoshino, thank you so much for this book and for really selecting this issue as a way of giving us all an optimistic view of our own government. Thanks, Kenji.
Thanks, Sean.
Kenji Yoshino is constitutional law professor at New York University School of Law and author of Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. By Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. Featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Every once in a while, we use our studio as a music studio.
She was a good companion. Eyes like the Grand Canyon. She was an American Beauty.
That's me on mandolin jamming with Tennessee-born Drew Holcomb playing a cut, American Beauty, off his new album, Medicine. Drew and his band The Neighbors are currently headlining an American tour, festivals like Bonnaroo, and they started their own festival last year, Moon River Music Fest in Memphis. Memphis, music, and Holcomb's latest album, Medicine, they go together, he says, in a lifetime story of healing that he shared along with his sweet Tennessee singing voice.
I grew up in a Southern Christian family, and still in a lot of ways would identify myself in those ways. But the problem is so much of people's identity about being an American or being a, you know, their religious is built around fear. And, you know, so much from in my childhood, I realized the world I grew up in was built around fear of death and fear of hell. And so I think like our healthcare problems, a lot of times, like if you look at, you know, some massive percentage of our healthcare spending is spent on the last like 18 months of life. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's, we just had this culturally, we have a massive fear of death. You know, I don't know, you know, everybody's different perspective on that, but I think if we let go of some of our defenses about America being the greatest country in the world, or people are coming in to take something away from us, you know, and like a great example, I think, of this, I have a friend and I grew up in high school with who moved out to the West Coast, and he's this staunch anti-immigration guy, you know, mm-hmm. and he's like, you don't know what it's like in LA. And I just said, what is the name of your city? You're not the first one. You are the immigrant to Los Angeles. You know, it was founded by Mexican Americans.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just so much obvious, like, point of view that's missing in a lot of our national dialogue.
You had wheelchair in your life.
I did. Yeah.
My kids, you know, they're you know, grown now. They're teenagers. But each one of them went through this experience of, like, you know, going outside in the world and coming back home and telling Dad, you know, Dad, there aren't a lot of wheelchairs out there. So when I meet somebody who had that experience in their life, it's interesting to me because it wasn't in my life when I was little.
Yeah. So my brother was born with spina bifida.
Uh-huh.
I was three at the time. His name was Jay. And he, lived a pretty amazing and three-dimensional life that was cut short. Due to some seizure brain kind of problems that happened when I was in high school. I didn't think about it at all when I was a kid. It was just part of my life. But then once he passed away, and then I went on to college, and some people found the story to be important and relevant, other people didn't, you know, and it was very shocking to me that I thought that I had this special story, which I do think is a special story. But it made me look at it in more complex ways. But my favorite part of that experience was my parents. You know, we went backpacking as a family, and Dad would carry Jay, and we'd go camping, and, you know, and he did the ski thing where he figured out how to get him in one of those, like, seat deals where he could get out there. And more than anything, his goal was to give Jay a story to tell, you know, which was, I think, a real important thing for any kid, but especially a kid who's kind of on the outside.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
How's the meaning of that changed as you get older?
I think the older I get, if I'm honest, my brother becomes a little bit more of a tragic figure than he did when I was a kid. There was a certain kind of justification for his suffering that kind of through a religious perspective that rang really true for me in my younger years. And now I don't know if I'm sure about it anymore, you know. Regardless of kind of how I felt about it when I was 17 when he passed, and now as a 32-year-old and at 15 years, the biggest takeaway is that I loved him and I miss him. And I'm glad my parents engaged his life with a lot of energy and didn't feel sorry for themselves.
And enriched yours.
Absolutely.
Well, Drew, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
Really great time.
Goodbye came like the morning sun. She fired shots from a loaded gun. Wish I had held her longer. Wish I had held her longer.
Drew Holcomb's new album is Medicine. Our full studio session in CR4 you can hear at thetakeaway.org. As I mentioned earlier, I'm down in Washington, D.C., which I have covered one way or another in my many-decade career. My colleague Todd Zwillick has had D.C. as his beat for much of his entire career. What is it, going on about 4 decades now, Todd?
We're getting there.
Well, with the departures of Frontier Funny Man, Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson, someone you knew well, right?
Yeah,
right? Mr. One-Liner himself, the late Speaker Tip O'Neill, who's a legend here, the literary genius, the late Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and the master of overdrama, Speaker Newt Gingrich. There's really no contest for who's the most poetic, comedic, and dramatic voice in Washington right now, right?
And the most maddening, it's Antonin Scalia, most maddening to a lot of people. He is the character of Washington, the most humor from the bench, the most maddening character, and the biggest magnet for people's cheering or their ire.
And he's amazing. I've interviewed him. He says things like, the jurisprudential twilight zone between two errant lines of precedent. Sounds almost like Shakespeare. Well, Justice Scalia is the subject of a new play called The Originalist, currently playing at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. Here's a little.
The court has been my theater, and I have the costumes. And yes, I sometimes perform from the bench, shocking the keepers of the liberal flame in this country. Well, let me tell you something. They're easy to shock.
Fictional Justice Scalia, portrayed by actor Edward Gero. Our own Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick got to attend one of the performances on Sunday, right?
Yeah, Sunday night.
And you have a good time?
Oh, it was a phenomenal performance and a real Washington experience.
And everybody knows that Scalia is an opera fanatic, so Shakespeare really works well with this kind of operatic character.
And there are themes of Shakespeare. There are themes of opera. The play opens with a Mozart opera where Scalia says you can find the true meaning of interaction in listening to an opera if you really listen. People don't expect when you talk about Antonin Scalia to talk about listening and openness. But this play really tries to upend some of that. Now, you're listening there to longtime Washington actor Ed Gero. He's played a lot of Shakespeare roles in Washington, D.C. Richard, Henry, you go down the list. Locals know him really well. Here he interprets Scalia, and it's not a big stretch because these two men look like brothers. They're from the same part of the world. They have the same Italian DNA, as Ed Gero told me. Listen to part of their performance here where Ed Gero channels Scalia on his jurisprudential attitude.
To interpret the Constitution as it is written and as it was understood when the authors crafted the original document. It's as simple as that. Now, the other side of the argument is obvious and wrong. The Constitution is a living document. It must change with the times. Nonsense. Society changes. Fashion changes. The Constitution stands.
He sounds a little like him.
He does. And the two have met. He did a lot of studies of Scalia's interviews, his speeches. I got a chance to sit down and talk with Ed Gero about the performance, where I asked him how he was drawing the sketch.
So in your role, you're drawing a caricature of Antonin Scalia.
Caricature? No, no, no. That's a bad word in my business. No, 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 no.
Why?
Well, because caricature implies making fun of and making it larger and to lampoon it. It's a pejorative, and I don't want to do that at all. I want to honor who he is and what he does with an equal amount of integrity in terms of my discipline as he would apply to his. And that's a pretty high bar. And it's a hard sword's edge to walk in a politically charged body politic into which I enter every evening.
Got a little trouble there with the caricature line there. But it is true. He is walking into a body politic. The audience from D.C. has various views about Scalia one way or another.
They do. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg, has seen this play. Apparently she adored it. Scalia's dear friend. Justice Scalia has not seen it. I'm told he's recused himself from this performance. Ed Gero himself, John, it's fascinating. You know, he says it's not a caricature. He has a great deal of respect for Antonin Scalia, and I think he's on a mission to provide a picture of discourse. Scalia in this play does listen. He listens closely. He's extremely confident. He is always right and never wrong. But Gero says he's not arrogant. No, not arrogant. There is a place for discourse in a town at this point that desperately needs it. Now, I want to play you a scene from the play here. There's only three cast members in this play, and one of the cast members is a young clerk. Her name is Kat. She's played by Carrie Warren. She's a young woman of color. She's a, quote, flaming liberal, in her own words, and she really forms the dialectic. She really goes at it with Scalia here, and it's really most of the play. Listen.
How does it feel?
Sir?
Interviewing for the position of Supreme Court law clerk? There are only 36 of you on earth at a time, four for a justice. Most law school graduates would sell their souls to be in your place.
It feels like a tremendous honor, sir.
Oh, a stock answer. How does it really feel?
Terrifying.
Well, it's not usually fatal. No one's died from clerking. Yet.
A little whiplash in there, maybe a little bit. You know, it's so interesting hearing these words and hearing what you're saying about this play and about how it's really talking about a respect for discourse, talking with Kenji just a moment ago about this respect for the law, the courtroom as a place of theater and reverence for law and freedom and institutions. These are great ways of bringing this out
Yeah.
Theater, literature, words.
It really is. There is the theater of the courtroom, which Scalia exalts in and acknowledges. Mm. There is the court of the theater when you're at the arena stage. And for court watchers, this play has a lot because it deals with the hot button issues that you want to hear from the court. Guns, the Heller case. Mm. It deals with Roe. It deals with the Defense of Marriage Act, with quotes from Scalia's own blistering dissent. If you don't remember what it is, go back and give it a read, and that's part of the play too. But discourse and listening is really part of it, which sort of upends the audience's expectations of Scalia. And the reason why I played you that interchange with Kat, I want you to listen to this last part of my interview with Ed Giroux, because Kat, you know, she really represents the audience. She's the flaming liberal. Let's face it, this is Washington, D.C. A lot of the theater-going audience, they're not Scalia lovers.
I've done a lot of characters that audiences love to hate in Shakespeare. This is the first time I've done a character that audiences actually hate to love, right? And they come out and say, no, I'm not going to give it to him. He can't be a person. I can't buy that. I need to go home and take a shower. So there's a certain sense of humor about that. But that's really who he is. But I think by the end of the play, and you're right, she is the person who's asking the questions that we all want to ask from our point of view, what we think is right, and rail at the person who apparently has the power to change all of our circumstances, and let's put it all in one basket.
Play is called The Originalist. That's Ed Giroux, the actor. The only question is it coming to Broadway? Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
They're going to try to get it to New York.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Once upon a time, Jake was the local whiz kid who made it big. Everyone knew it. Then he got small. But not everybody back home had the latest news about Jake.
So what are you up to now, man? Come on, give me the rundown. Make me jealous.
I'm actually doing, early childhood education stuff now.
Whoa, that sounds big.
I was doing, a bunch of tech stuff, and I was like, you know what? How about I give back, you know?
Awesome.
Yeah, it's going well.
Kids.
Yeah, they're the future.
We'll see, but...
Mm-hmm. No, they are. They will be.
We'll see.
No, it's undoubted the children are the future.
Crazy, man.
Yeah, so... And my sister's pregnant, so I'm, staying at her place and just kind of helping her out a little bit. Getting my ducks in a row.
Yeah.
Having to get your ducks in a row after thinking you are on Easy Street is what you do if you are among the adult beginners. That's a premise in a new movie about people having to start over who never thought they would, who could use a few life skills. Jake moves in with his pregnant sister, played by Rose Byrne, and brother-in-law, played by Bobby Cannavale. This movie attracted director Ross Katz, he told us, because it was a story with emotional impact about grown-up siblings with plenty of laughs. Comedian Nick Kroll stars as Jake, and Kroll also wrote the script.
For me, the idea of this movie is based on being the younger brother of older siblings who have kids and feeling very much like a selfish, useless person who couldn't care for them given the opportunity. And so I think this movie sort of was cathartic in that regard.
How did you find this particular project? I mean, you guys are a really interesting combination of the dramatic and the comedic here.
Well, this is one of those things that kind of never happens in Hollywood or Indiewood or, you know, which is an amazing script that has an amazing cast already. And what they didn't have was a director. And so Nick was a producer on the project, originated the story, came up with the idea for the story. And Rose Byrne and Bobby Cannavale were all attached and they were looking for a director. And I raised my hand when I read it, and I said, the movie I made previously, which was called Taking Chance, is not funny, but I am.
Yeah. Did you have to do something to convince him of that?
We had a great conversation, and I knew that Ross could handle the dramatic lines within the story and also the character stuff and had a great visual eye. We showed the movie to Bobby Cannavale, who called me and goes, Nick, I saw Ross Katz's movie. It's a hilarious. but we realized that we could meet in the middle and be collaborative in that. But he is a naturally funny guy and understood the story.
Russ, you mentioned that you raised your hand when you read the script, and you mentioned also a moment before that Indywood. Is there an actual place called Indywood? It's like a table at a restaurant in a corner somewhere that,
you know,
where you raise your hand?
And I feel like there, you know, it's so funny because I've made a lot of independent films,
right,
and I feel like there's a whole Indywood community. There's sort of like classes of you know, Hollywood and Indywood, and there's a Cafe 101 in L.A. is very Indywood.
Yeah. Indywood.
Being on this show is a real point of accomplishment within Indywood.
Absolutely.
This is like first base in Indywood. The takeaway.
I would say this is sloppy seconds.
Sloppy seconds. All right, great. So Rose Byrne is your sister in this film.
Yes.
And the package was like already the concept, right?
We went to her first because we needed to find my sister, and getting Rose, who is so talented both dramatically and comedically, was a real get. We got her, and then I sat down with her, ironically, at the 101, Cafe 101 in L.A., had breakfast, and she said, you know, I don't want to be weird, but I think my boyfriend would be amazing to play my husband in the movie. And I said, who's your boyfriend? She said, Bobby Cannavale. And I said, well, that's convenient because we genuinely wrote the part for him. It was a coincidence.
This Indywood.
Yes.
Although I have to say, Rose Byrne scares the living daylights out of me. After Bridesmaids, I mean, she's just such a powerful, blow away, like laser eyes character. I mean, what kind of energy is that to work with?
She was great. I mean, she can handle it all. She really is like a real triple threat. And she just is a total team player as well as a super funny and a very talented dramatic actor.
And I was a producer before I was a director, and I worked with Rose on Marie Antoinette. And Rose was, I mean, she was wearing a corset. She had 2 hours of hair and makeup. She was...
which he made me do in this film as well.
Yeah.
I never understood why.
Nick did 2 hours of hair and makeup. And
of course it was extreme, Ross.
And she was a total pro. Not only that, she's fun. She's funny. She's grounded. She just knocks it out of the park. It's like as a director to watch her work, it's pretty effortless.
So what does this come from in your life, this premise here, adult beginners?
Well,
you mentioned it a little bit, but...
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I think, one, I have 12 nieces and nephews, and the idea that my siblings literally would rather have a 14-year-old girl watch their children than me. And so I thought that would be an interesting premise to see a guy like me having to take care of a child. But adult beginners, I think it's people of my age, I think, feel like they have the trappings of adulthood. But still feel like a child in a lot of ways, whether it's me or siblings or friends who have families and the responsibilities of adulthood and yet don't feel quite like they are adults. And so that's oftentimes how I feel, and I feel like we tried to create a bunch of characters that are flawed and childlike in a lot of ways, even though they are starting businesses, having families, have jobs, mortgages, everything that goes into modern adulthood.
So are you happy with how this all came out?
Thrilled.
Yeah.
Thrilled. Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, I have an older brother, and we have trouble connecting because he lives in San Francisco. He has two kids and he's got a hectic life. He's a lawyer, and we try and we text and we call, but it's sort of brought home for me the importance of family
so touching. You text and you call.
Yeah, I know.
It's really
close. Yeah. It's really, we're
tight. Fishing, maybe. Basketball.
Yeah, no, this is the first film that I've made, and it's been well over a 3-year process. So to just complete a film, especially in Indywood, feels like an accomplishment. We've been doing screenings of it and doing Q&As and talking to people, and the response that we get at least once a screening is like, I got to call my brother.
Right.
I got to call my sister. And there's something nice about that.
Right.
And here to experience adult beginners with an audience is so great because people laugh and you really feel that in the audience. It's funny. And, you know, that's very gratifying.
Nick Kroll is the star of Adult Beginners, directed by Ross Katz. The movie is in theaters, iTunes, and on demand on April 24th. And here's something to take with you today. Like, everybody knows mac and cheese is the color of a bright orange LA sunset, right? But not for long. Kraft mac and cheese, under pressure from healthier competitors, so-called, and controversial food blogger The Food Babe, will be stripping all artificial preservatives and synthetic colors from its famous pasta and cheese mix. What's next? Artisanal white Velveeta? What could be the real color of Velveeta? Could it be blue? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints. I do my best to get back to you personally. Tweet me your questions. Again, you can tweet me your questions at Jay Hockenberry. And if you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. Find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.